up on KUCB News. Raiders basketball picks up 4 wins at home in one day, and today is the 2nd anniversary of the loss of the fishing vessel Destination. Stay tuned.
Programming on KUCB is made possible by Redfish Electronics, now providing new, used, and refurbished computers, tablets, iPods, MP3s, phones, phone accessories, and flat screens. We also carry external hard drives for your digital storage needs. Redfish Electronics is located in the airport parking lot next to Northport Rentals. Redfish Electronics can be reached at 359-2205.
Good afternoon. You're listening to KUCB 89.7 FM on Alaska. I'm Zoe Sobel with some local news on Monday, February 11th, 2019. The Unalaska Raiders basketball teams picked up 4 wins on Saturday, sweeping the visiting Toke Wolverines. While the games were originally scheduled to be split over Friday and Saturday, a mechanical cancellation by Penn Air condensed the games to a day of doubleheaders. In the boys' first matchup, Unalaska came away with a 51-32 victory, with scoring contributions from 10 players. The evening game was a closer affair. The Raiders still posted a 52-34 win, with senior Trevor Wilson recording 32 points, almost single-handedly outscoring Toke. The Raiders stand 7 wins and 3 losses on the season. With wins on Saturday, the girls extended their win streak to 4. They're now 5-7 for the year. In the afternoon, the team put away the Wolverines 52-35 with points coming from 10 players. In the nightcap, junior Haley Wilson paced Unalaska with 20 points and Kayla Villamore chipped in 10. Unalaska took the win 53-31. The Raiders have a week off from traveling, but will hit the road next week heading to Dillingham for their final games of the regular season. Quiet areas, comfy seats, and a coffee shop. These are just a few of the things Unalaskans want from the city's upcoming library renovation, according to new survey results released last month. 174 people responded to the online questionnaire, which librarian Karen Kresh says was designed to add data and detail to ongoing discussions about how to improve the 20-year-old building.
The most important takeaway for me, and I think the architects are on the same page, is that quiet spaces are very important to people in the community, and then almost equally important are social spaces.
On a scale of 1 to 10, the average survey respondent ranked the importance of very quiet spaces as an 8. The presence of more social spaces received an average ranking of 7.
So as we move forward with the design, we'll have to find a building plan that kind of balances those two demands, which are kind of on opposite sides of a building spectrum, I guess, or a space spectrum, but they're both very, very important to people. So we'll have to find a design that can accommodate both of those community needs.
It's still unclear if that final design will include a coffee shop. 62% of survey respondents want space for a private business to sell tea and coffee, and 64% want an area to eat their own snacks. But Kresh says the issue of food and drink is still pretty divisive.
Some people are very enthusiastic about it, and some people are very opposed to it. So it was good to get some numbers behind, you know, how many people really want this, and is this something that we should look at?
Kresh says architects will continue looking at those options. The same goes for self-checkout stands, which she says earned a surprising amount of community support.
Whenever we've asked about self-checkout in public meetings and in staff meetings too, it's always been like, no, I don't think we need that. But the survey respondents, only 20% of people said they would never use it.
By contrast, 49% of respondents said they would use self-checkout often, and 31% said they'd use it occasionally.
The benefit of a survey like this, especially with the good turnout we got, is that you get the silent majority voice. And so if people are not coming to the meetings, or if they're coming to the meetings and just not speaking up for whatever reason, they can be heard in a forum like this. That doesn't mean necessarily that we will include self-checkout, but I think it's something that we probably want to give ourselves the flexibility to provide down the road.
Unalaskans should soon know how much flexibility and space the library will have to address all the options under consideration. Kresh says architects will be on island until Thursday for another round of public planning meetings and a presentation at City Hall.
The main goal for this visit is to understand from the community and from City Council whether we should pursue a larger building footprint that has space for a larger event or community gathering space, or if we should stick with the original plan, which had the smaller square footage.
The discussion scheduled for tonight at the library has been postponed until Wednesday due to a flight not arriving. An open house will run from 5 to 6 p.m. Wednesday with a presentation by the architects at 6. Architects will share concept drawings and present updated designs based on community feedback. Finally, on Thursday morning, the library will host a special meeting at Storytime to gather ideas about the children's room. KUCB will keep you updated on the events throughout the week, so join us every day for the newscast here on 89.7 FM. Today marks the second anniversary of the loss of the fishing vessel Destination. With six crew members on board, its sinking ranked as the Bering Sea Crab Fleet's deadliest accident in more than a decade. KUCB's Laura Craigle filed the story in July when federal investigators released a report saying the boat capsized after it was weighed down by ice.
On February 11, 2017, the Destination was pushing through rough, frigid waters a few miles from St. George Island. Then, in about 4 minutes, the boat went from carrying 200 crab pots and preparing for a paleo season to vanishing without a mayday call.
Whatever happened, happened very, very quickly, and there's no one left to tell their story.
Chris O'Neill is a spokesperson for the National Transportation Safety Board. He says NTSB investigators reviewed the vessel's mechanical history, pored over weather reports, and interviewed almost 50 people to piece together the probable cause of the accident.
The captain's decision to proceed into heavy freezing spray conditions without ensuring the Destination had a margin of stability to withstand that accumulation of ice led to the loss of the vessel.
In better conditions, O'Neill says the boat could have carried the 200 crab pots without a problem. But with gale force winds kicking up freezing spray, the Destination became weighed down by as many as 340,000 pounds of ice.
So if you look at that probable cause, yes, this is a preventable accident.
With no survivors to interview, O'Neill says NTSB couldn't determine why the crew didn't beat more ice to mitigate that weight, especially a well-respected crew with more than 70 years of collective fishing experience.
Very hard to know with certainty the mindset, the decision-making process, and what factors were or were not considered. But certainly through the evidence that was collected throughout the investigation, we recognize the pressures that are associated with the industry.
Investigators found several signs that the crew was feeling the pressure of time. The vessel had gotten a late start on crab after fishing for cod. Its delivery deadline was looming, and a few weeks earlier, a crew member had texted his father, "Oh my God, I haven't slept in days." The strains of commercial fishing are familiar to Dyer George. He's captain of the FV Polar Sea, which was fishing for crab in the same area as the Destination the day it went down.
The whole crew was exhausted. I was beating ice with my crew.
They pulled into port safely after hours spent heaving sledgehammers to break ice. But in an interview weeks later, George said the Destination sinking was a wake-up call for the entire fleet.
And it's devastating. They say what? The most accidents happen 10 minutes from home. I mean, he was so close to St. Paul. He was in St. George. He could anchor up there and wait for daylight and get some ice off the boat. We have no need to rush as much. You know, we're going to catch the crab. So why are we going to push that hard?
In a fishery that's made huge safety strides in the last two decades, U.S. Coast Guard officials say crabbers have taken the sinking to heart. Almost 50 boats participated in a voluntary safety check last year to review their stability criteria, and there were no fatalities in this winter crab season. The loss of the Destination marks the fleet's deadliest accident since 2005. In Unalaska, I'm Laura Craigle.
This winter, the Bering Sea Crab Fleet has reported no fatalities or vessel losses, according to the U.S. Coast Guard. Officials remind fishermen to stay on top of their safety practices by confirming vessel stability, watching the forecast, and always wearing protective gear. Moscow has been building its military presence in the Arctic, and at a forum at the U.S. Senate last month, one Russia expert says she's grown increasingly concerned. Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin reports that while Russia's Arctic ambitions may be worrisome, so are the lack of ambitions on the part of the United States.
Heather Conley, program director at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, brought satellite photos to show U.S. Senators Wrangell Island, 300 miles from Alaska's northwest coast.
You are seeing the images of a new naval base on Wrangell Island, and you're looking at pictures of the SOPCA-2 radar installation.
Conley says it's just one of the ways Russia has expanded its military footprint in the high north.
The uptick in Russian submarine activity elsewhere has that sort of Cold War-esque feel to it. But what we've seen over the last several years is runways extensions that can take MiGs that could carry both conventional and potentially nuclear-capable missiles. We're seeing special forces. That is not search and rescue. That is not for what I would say for their economic ambitions in the Arctic.
Conley was an official at the State Department in the George W. Bush administration. She says the U.S. has to up its game on its northern border. The Arctic is sometimes called a zone of peace and cooperation, but Conley says Russia has shown it's willing to use military force to achieve political objectives.
The exercises, the advanced weaponry that Russia is introducing into the Arctic is not necessarily compatible, I would argue, with the zone of peace. So vigilance, I am not worried. I have great confidence, but we need to have our eyes wide open.
Malte Humpert at the Arctic Institute shares many of Conley's concerns, but he says Alaskans shouldn't worry about imminent attack. Humpert says the military buildup is in part about domestic politics for President Putin.
Russian leadership wants to project a strong image of, you know, Russia reclaiming its Arctic heritage.
Also, Humpert says Russia sees the Arctic Ocean as key to asserting its power in the world. So does China. But Humpert says the U.S. is not taking strategic advantage of its own Arctic location.
The Arctic Ocean is really the only ocean in the world where the Navy's capabilities, the U.S.'s Navy's capabilities, lack behind of what the Russians have.
At the Senate Arctic Roundtable, several participants said America needs clear Arctic strategies in diplomacy, science, and security. And they wished for one official whose sole job was to pursue them. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
This was the year Congress was finally going to spend some serious money to build an icebreaker. A Senate spending bill has $750 million for a new icebreaker, which would bring the Coast Guard's fleet to three. But that money is caught in a fight over whether to build President Trump's wall at the southern border. Still, there's more than one way to break ice. There's renewed interest in using private and foreign ships to help fill the expected demand for commercial icebreaking. Polar Institute Director Mike Sefraga of Fairbanks says it would be like Uber, but instead of a person calling for a car, it would be a commercial ship calling for the support vessels needed to transit Arctic waters.
The idea of an Uber for icebreakers, a St. Lawrence Seaway model that could collaborate among the northern countries in making a pathway across the north so that there's escort, there's search and rescue, it's paid by fees of commerce, that might be a really good model to take a look at because that's the future.
Sefraga spoke at an Arctic roundtable in the U.S. Senate in late January. The Russian Arctic saw record traffic in 2018 with tankers, cruise ships, and cargo ships. Russia charges for icebreaking and other services along the Northern Sea route. Sefraga says by 2030 or 2040, commercial ships will be interested in so-called across-the-top routes beyond the shipping lanes Russia controls. But barriers remain for Arctic shipping. Even with years of dramatically shrinking sea ice, the travel season only lasts for days or weeks. And Senator Lisa Murkowski says fee-based icebreakers would still need a lot of support infrastructure. She sponsored a bill last year that calls for building deepwater ports in northern Alaska.
Not just one port, but a system of Arctic ports, ports of refuge for ships in trouble, and ports to send, receive, and transship goods and people.
Key Congress members of both parties in the House and Senate support building new Coast Guard icebreakers, but at least for now, that call is drowned out by the debate over security at the southern border. And that's the news from Unalaska. I'm Zoe Sobel. You're listening to KUCB 89.7 FM. Find us online at kucb.org. Please stay tuned for your local and marine weather forecast.